Welcome to this week's edition of Far West Texas. Readings from the Big Bend Sentinel, the Monahans News, and the Fort Stockton Pioneer, read by volunteers and staff. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
Hello, this is Kay reading the Big Bend Sentinel for Thursday, October 20th, 2022. Presidio County Commissioner's Court grapples with rising employee pay by Sam Karras. Sam at BigBendSentinel.com. Marfa. At last week's meeting of the Presidio County Commissioner's Court, the commissioners deliberated for hours on how best to raise wages and retirement packages fairly on a limited budget. No immediate action was taken, but target dates were set towards setting and implementing pay raises across departments. To kick off the meeting, Roxanne Aldridge of the Texas County District Retirement System gave a presentation on implementing cost of living adjustments, COLA, for the county's retirees. County Auditor Patty Roach offered a number of scenarios based on preliminary research. Essentially, how big a bite out of the county budget the different packages would take. The commissioners took no action last Wednesday, awaiting further information and projections from Roach. Precinct 1 Commissioner Brenda Silva Bentley advised that it would be best to decide on retirement COLAs after raises for current employees were discussed and decided. The commissioners tentatively scheduled another presentation from Roach on November 9th. "I'd rather look at more accurate numbers and see what's available to us," Bentley said. Later in the meeting, the commissioners discussed adopting a new salary schedule, essentially raising wages for county employees across the board, rather than approving raises department by department. A committee of county employees was assembled with representatives from the Sheriff's Department, Treasurer's Office, Tax Assessor Collector, and other vital offices. Commissioner Bentley said that time was of the essence. She felt that the local cost of living had already outpaced wages and was affecting long-term residents' ability to stay in their jobs and the county's ability to attract new talent. "In terms of housing, I don't know what people are going to do unless they already have something in place," she said. Roach offered some advice to the commissioners based on comparisons she'd researched from government officials in neighboring Brewster County. By her estimation, county employees in Roads and Bridges and the Presidio County Jail made the closest to competitive wages, but there was room for improvement across the board. She advised looking into the county's biggest employers, like the Big Bend Banks and Customs and Border Protection, to compare salaries based on skill sets, like accounting and secretarial work. Additionally, she felt it was important to distinguish between senior and junior employees on the proposed pay schedule. "It's not going to be easy. It's going to take a lot of work," she cautioned. After the discussion of the new pay scale, Joel Nunez of the Presidio County Sheriff's Office, PSCO, gave a presentation about the dire state of turnover in his department and requested raises for officers and dispatch. The department decided on the dollar amount with input from the county auditor. Nunez was concerned that competitive wages elsewhere, particularly in Customs and Border Protection, was skimming off potential PCSO employees. "We get them trained and certified, and they're valuable, so they get recruited to other agencies and get paid more money," he explained. "We wouldn't be doing our jobs as employers without doing this for our employees." Precinct 1 Commissioner Bentley expressed frustration that the Sheriff's Office has come before Commissioner's Court many times asking for raises and funding. She came prepared with research into wages across departments in the county and accompanying retention data. My fear is we're going to take too far a leap with this and leave everyone else behind, she said. Her comments led to a heated back and forth between Bentley and Presidio County Sheriff Danny Dominguez, who was also in attendance. Bentley suggested that high turnover in the PCSO was due to poor management and not because of low wages. Dominguez insisted that it was because of broader cultural attitudes. That's just our country right now. Nobody wants to work, he said. County Judge Cinderella Guevara restored order in the court and clarified why the raises had been brought before the commissioners in the first place. She had brought the item because she regularly interacts with PCSO and Presidio County Jail employees and wanted to circumvent burnout. This is not intended so that some people can stay behind and some can get ahead. That is not the intention at all, she said. The commissioners ultimately took no action on the proposed PCSO raises. Instead, they set a target goal of December 14th for the committee to propose a new pay schedule so that it could be adopted sometime in the new year. The timing of these conversations could prove tricky. Presidio County Commissioner's Court will welcome two new faces come January. Precinct 2 will welcome Margarito Hernandez, who is running unopposed. Precinct 4 is contested this November between Gary Wilbanks and David Beebe. Roach advised the commissioners on the limits of their ability to decide budgetary items in the aftermath of an election. You can't govern a future court's decisions, but you can put in writing that it is your intent, she explained. Photo courtesy of Blackwell School. Students at the Blackwell School, in a 1959 archival photograph that is part of the Blackwell School's extensive collection of images, objects, and stories. On Monday, U.S. President Joe Biden signed the Blackwell School National Historic Site Act, making the school America's newest national park. Biden signs Blackwell School National Historic Site Act by Allegra Hobbs, Allegra at BigBendSentinel.com. Marfa. On Monday, President Biden signed the Blackwell School National Historic Site Act into law, marking the conclusion of a years-long quest by alumni, activists, and lawmakers to see the adobe structure, which served as a school for Mexican-American students from 1909 to 1965, designated a National Historic Site. Members of the Blackwell School Alliance, a group of alumni and school proponents that had lobbied for the designation, gathered with supporters at the site on Tuesday to celebrate the long-awaited victory. For alumni, the designation is an important milestone in the preservation of the school's history, now formally recognized not only for its personal significance to those who attended, but its national significance as a site commemorating the segregation of Mexican-American students in the U.S. I have so many memories of Blackwell, bad ones, but I learned from them. Starting today, it's going to be a new tomorrow for me. This will be my past, said alumnus and Blackwell School Alliance member Jesse Silva. I have brought it up so many times because of the pain that I felt as a child when I was attending Blackwell. What my parents went through, what my brothers and sister went through, and I have learned that it's people who care that matter. The people that hurt us aren't here, are they? The people that matter are here. The Alliance was formed 16 years ago, beginning with an informal reunion of alumni passionate about seeing the school's history preserved. When those alumni got wind of rumors that the Marfa ISD board might be selling the property, they struck a deal with the board to lease it in order to ensure its preservation. The group's efforts grew exponentially from there. Several years ago, a letter-writing campaign urged the designation of the schoolhouse as a National Historic Site. Legislation to that end was first introduced last year and was finally passed by Congress in September. As of Monday, with President Biden's signature, the alliance's years-long fight is finally over. The designation makes the site a part of the National Park System, and it will be maintained by the National Park Service. The next step is for NPS to acquire the land the structure sits on from the city of Marfa, a process the service said could take more than a year. Gretel Enke, president of the Blackwell School Alliance, noted on Tuesday that the victory of the designation is just the beginning when it comes to preserving and conveying the vital slice of local and American history. Everybody's stories matter, and we hope that this is the tip of the iceberg, that this is the beginning of opening a new era of people understanding that borderland stories, Hispanic-Latino stories, are American stories, said Enke. This is a critical piece of American history, and yes, it is a very personal, local story, and it is so much more than that. We are celebrating a great milestone today, and know that this is just the beginning of a big, new chapter. The site is now one of few devoted specifically to the commemoration of Latino history. Congressman Tony Gonzalez, who had backed the bill, came to Marfa to celebrate with the alliance and noted the designation's national significance. The only other National Historic Site commemorating Latino history, to his knowledge, is the Cesar E. Chavez National Monument in California. This is a win for our state, a win for our country, said Gonzalez. It's not just about Marfa, Texas. Senator John Cornyn was unable to attend due to weather conditions, but representatives from his office were present at the small gathering. In an interview with the Big Bend Sentinel, Gonzalez echoed Enke's sentiments that the designation is just the beginning. Now the congressman hopes to work with the alliance and alumni to keep that momentum going, which will include working with House Committee on Natural Resources Chairman Raul M. Grijalva, the White House, and the National Park Service to assess what the group needs moving forward. I sit on the Appropriations Committee, and part of this is to go, what appropriation funds do you need in order to make this site one of the nation's most amazing sites that brings to life the stories, so it's not just a plaque on a wall that people drive by, said Gonzalez. The input of alumni, he said, will be integral to that process. Blackwell alumnus Lionel Salgado told the Sentinel that he is hopeful the new designation will bring more attention to the site and the history it has to tell. All around here, there used to be schools like this, but there's no sign of anything anymore, he said. Nobody knows what we have here. Now, people are going to find out what we have here. Brothers charged in Hudspeth County shooting now held in Marfa and Alpine by Allegra Hobbs. Allegra at BigBendSentinel.com. By Debbie Nathan. NAESS2@gmail.com. Tri-County. Twin brothers Mark and Mike Shepherd, both facing criminal charges in the Hudspeth County shooting that left one migrant dead and another injured, are currently being detained in Marfa and Alpine. The brothers are facing manslaughter and assault with a deadly weapon charges in connection with the September 27th shooting, in which authorities say the men shot at a group of migrants who were drinking water from a reservoir around 4 miles south of Sierra Blanca. According to arrest affidavits, Mark Shepherd told investigators that his brother Mike had fired 2 shots near the reservoir that evening, believing he was shooting at javelinas. Mike Shepherd is being held in the Brewster County Jail in Alpine as of October 11th, the Brewster County Sheriff's Office confirmed. Mark Shepherd is being held in the Presidio County Jail in Marfa on a $250,000 bond. The Brewster County Sheriff's Office could not confirm the bond amount for Mike Shepherd. Both are being held on charges of assault with a deadly weapon and will appear in virtual court on October 27th for individual bond hearings. Both men were initially apprehended by the El Paso County Sheriff's Office and charged with manslaughter on September 29th, and were held in the El Paso County Jail for several days. They were then transferred to Hudspeth County before being released on $250,000 bonds and subsequently turned themselves in when the additional charges were brought against them. Brewster County Sheriff Ronnie Dodson said the transfer of the inmates was made by Hudspeth County Sheriff Arvin West in order to avoid any potential conflict of interest. West has stated publicly that he knows both men personally and that Mark Shepherd was previously employed by the Hudspeth County Jail. "It was the sheriff's idea," said Dodson. "He didn't want to be a part of the investigation because he knew him, and that's always tough on us." Sheriff West did not immediately return a request for comment. According to the affidavits, migrants in the group told investigators that two men pulled over along Farm Road 1111 around 7 p.m. on the evening of September 27th, and that the driver fired two shots, striking and killing a man in their group and wounding a woman who was transferred to Del Sol Hospital in El Paso. Migrants said that one of the men had shouted in Spanish something to the effect of, "Come out, you sons of B blank, little asses," before revving the car's engine. Authorities traced the vehicle to Mike Shepherd, who declined to speak to them. But Mark Shepherd did speak to investigators, though he first said the brothers hadn't been at the location at the time of the shooting. He then said they had been there to shoot animals. First he said birds, then ducks, then javelinas. "The brothers did not go to see if they struck anything after the shots were fired," he said, "and attended a water board meeting after." Mark Shepherd's attorney, Richard Esper, told the Big Bend Sentinel he believes that his client, who allegedly was in the car with his brother, but is not believed to have pulled the trigger, will be acquitted of the charges he currently faces. "I can confidently say Mark Shepherd is not guilty of committing any kind of homicide or any kind of assault with a deadly weapon," he said. Mark Shepherd's attorney, Brent Meyer, said that he hopes that people will resist jumping to any conclusions as the investigation is ongoing. "We don't want anyone to jump to any conclusions about this case," said Meyer. "There's still a lot of evidence that we need to uncover, a lot more we need to learn about what took place before we jump to any conclusions." As of Wednesday, the brothers had not yet been indicted. In interviews with El Paso Matters, the families of the victims, Jesus Sepulveda Martinez, the family's who is deceased, and Brenda Berenice Casas Carrillo, have demanded justice for their loved ones. The case has elicited an outcry over what some believe to be a crime driven by bigotry, as activist groups have raised their voices to label the shooting a hate crime. Congresswoman Veronica Escobar has called on the Department of Justice to investigate it as such. RAICES, Races Texas, released a statement saying it had blown the whistle years prior on alleged abusive behavior by Mike Shepherd when he was warden at the West Texas Detention Facility. Bill Addington, a Sierra Blanca resident, told the Big Bend Sentinel that he witnessed Mark Shepherd yell at people for speaking Spanish 2 weeks prior to the shooting. Though one of the brothers is alleged to have yelled in Spanish just before firing and hitting the migrants, Addington said that the brothers do not speak Spanish. "Though maybe Mike knows how to say a few mean things in Spanish since he was an ICE warden, Addington told the Big Bend Sentinel. Or maybe he yelled in English, and some migrants understood enough English to know what he was saying. As for the unharmed migrants who were in the group, most of the adults are being held in El Paso Processing Center, an ICE detention facility. A 13-year-old girl who was in the group is in a Homeland Security children's facility. One adult migrant is being held at the El Paso County Jail. According to a relative who lives in the United States, the migrant being held in the jail is a 30-year-old whose middle name is Luis. The family member said Luis was fleeing fears of torture and death after being shot and hospitalized last year in Mexico in an incident that one family member surmises was caused by drug traffickers in the area. Luis had spent years in Texas and New Mexico before being deported, trying to return, and being caught and deported again, said the family member. He has three children born in the United States. He found himself in Sierra Blanca because he was trying to travel to the U.S. to earn enough money in order to bring his family to safety in America, said the relative. At a recent court hearing, Luis's attorney told a judge that his client was standing next to the man who was fatally shot. After the shooting, his attorney said, he led the group to the road where Border Patrol frequently passes, and he went looking for agents to apprehend them and take them to safety. He is now charged with felony illegal reentry, a federal crime punished by years in prison or, at the least, another deportation. Luis's immigration attorney, Zoe Bowman, with Las Americas Immigrant Advocacy Center in El Paso, is trying to obtain what's called a U visa for him and for six other survivors of the shooting. U visas are given to undocumented victims of crime who help law enforcement to bring their perpetrators to justice. At a recent federal court hearing in El Paso, a judge deemed Luis a flight risk and denied him bond. It's likely that he will be transferred to the West Texas Detention Facility near Sierra Blanca, Bowman told the Big Bend Sentinel, referring to the facility notorious for substandard conditions and reports of racialized violence perpetrated on detainees by staff, including Mike Shepherd himself when he was warden. Shepherd's employment was terminated just after the shootings. Luis's family member in the U.S. said that they have also been in touch with the woman injured in the shooting. I talked recently with her on the phone, and she said she was being released from the hospital soon. She seemed okay, except her voice sounded very depleted. School board ramps up bond campaign efforts, carries out facility repairs, and readies Blackwell sale. By Mary Cantrell. MKCANTRELL at BigBendSentinel.com. Marfa. This past week, the Marfa Independent School Board met for two meetings in which they discussed the $57 million school bond proposal on the upcoming November 8th general election ballot, as well as district operations and goals. The trustees have been meeting every week since the start of October to talk over messaging and public feedback regarding the bond proposal ahead of early voting. Mike Rhodes, education consultant with Claycomb Associates Architects, who has been assisting the district throughout the bond process and whose company will likely be chosen to take on the construction of a new K-12 school should the initiative win popular vote, was also in attendance. The district will continue to ramp up its campaign efforts, producing yard signs, knocking on doors, and sending out letters to remind voters 65 and over that they qualify to have their school district property taxes frozen, meaning the bond would not impact their pocketbooks. School security has also been heavily addressed in bond discussions, with the idea that one K-12 building would keep students safer than the current spread-out campus. Superintendent Oscar Aguero said he is hearing murmurs that the legislature, which meets this year, could enact stricter security measures for districts in the wake of the mass shooting in Uvalde. Districts could be required to have exterior walls or fences, for example, meaning spending more on their current facilities. We're going to be spending money that we don't have. We're going to have to reallocate a lot of our M&O, maintenance and operations, to things like school security, said Aguero. At a later regular board meeting, Aguero gave facilities updates, stating that the leaks in the Shorthorn Gym roof had been repaired and auditorium renovations were taking a little longer than anticipated due to crews having to re-level the floor, but were still on track. Flooring upgrades to other areas revealed termites in the high school secretary's office that will need to be treated, he said. The district is anticipating its exterior door safety audit, which will be conducted by the Texas School Safety Center, will happen this week. The district was also working on finalizing a lease agreement with Friends of the Hunter Gym, a newly established nonprofit which will work to renovate the historic Adobe Gym, then give it back to the school. Next, Aguero provided the board with updates regarding the Blackwell School property, which is owned by the district, becoming a National Historic Site. President Joe Biden officially signed the bill declaring Blackwell, which served as a segregated school for Hispanic students, on Monday, and Aguero was set to meet the following day with state representatives to celebrate at the site in Marfa. However, there were some technical hurdles popping up relating to the sale of the Blackwell building and land, said Aguero. The way the district's policies are written, in order to sell the building, they would have to put it up for public bid and sell to the highest bidder, while the National Park Service requires the site be donated. Aguero said moving forward, the district will likely donate Blackwell to the NPS, and a nonprofit affiliated with the NPS would donate whatever the appraised value is for the property back to the school. It can be done in policy that we donate it to them and another entity donate to us. So ultimately, the safest way to go is to make sure the park gets it, said Aguero. I think it's really great for Marfa ISD that we get to be part of this, because we're one of the few that gets to tell the story. The board approved new goals for early childhood literacy proficiency, early childhood math proficiency, and college, career, and military readiness that will be measured based on the percentage of students achieving a meets grade level or higher on their STAR tests, and more. The district is required by HB 3 to set and measure goals in public meetings. Board members worked to set new benchmarks, which they said were more attainable and realistic than goals previously set. Under the new guidelines, the district will work to achieve meets or higher in third grade reading from 53% to 62% and math from 26% to 42% by June 2027. For college, career, and military readiness, the district will assess how many students earned an industry-based certification, completed two advanced or dual credit courses, or met certain state-determined benchmarks in English, language arts, and reading and mathematics on the SAT, ACT, or TSIA. Their goal is to increase college, career, and military readiness from 38% to 52% in 2027.
Hi, this is Jack. I'm reading the Forestock and Pioneer for Thursday, October 20th, 2022. Town Hall Held for City Special Election by Sean Yorks. With early voting set to begin on Monday, October 24th for the November 8th midterm election, Fort Stockton is trying to get the word out about the city's home rule charter that will appear on the ballot for residents who live inside the city limits. A 15-member commission was set up last February to explore the idea of Fort Stockton becoming a home rule charter city, and the commission has been hashing out the details of what the charter should include ever since. The commission is unanimous in what it should include. Fort Stockton is the largest city in Texas that has not yet adopted a home rule charter. The commission held a meeting on October 17th at the Fort Stockton Convention Center to explain what a charter is, what changes would be made to the city, and to answer any questions from the public. About 15 people attended the meeting outside the commission and city council members. "This charter is sort of like our constitution," said Commissioner Ken Ripley. "It is our governing document. It will be if it's passed. It allows Fort Stockton, based on organization, powers, duties, functions, and essential procedures, our local government. Fort Stockton is a general law city and is regulated by the state. As a home rule charter city, the city and its residents would have more control." The hot topic of the night was game rooms. The community is split on the topic, and many feel that becoming a home rule charter city would force game rooms out, which isn't necessarily the case. "Everybody complains about game rooms being downtown," said Mayor Chris Alexander. "As a general law city, we have to go by what the state says. The only thing we can do to them is exactly what the city manager has included, which is we can go in and do some code enforcement. If they're not following our local code, then we can shut them down for a time period until they meet all the criteria. Surrounding towns such as Alpine, Pecos, and Odessa have stricter rules regarding game rooms. They're all home rule," Alexander said. "They can set those rules to guidelines that particular instance where they have more control over that particular situation. We're stuck with whatever the legislature decides to give us." Ripley said the city would not necessarily eliminate game rooms, but have stricter regulations. Reverend Jim Miles, a member of the Charter Review Commission, said that the members of the commission disagreed on some items, but did come to a unanimous vote on what to include in the potential new charter, adding that sometimes areas west of I-35 don't get a fair shake. "This is an opportunity to have more individual freedom. I think those that live here should govern here, and that's the way to do that," adding that it's a good, solid document. Charter quick facts. A charter is a fundamental governing document for a city in Texas. A charter enables citizens of a city to define the basic organization, powers, duties, functions, and essential procedures of the local government. A city must have a population of 5,000 or more in order to become a home rule city. Home rule municipalities have greater flexibility. This includes, among other things, the number of seats on a city council and how they are elected, the appointment of power between the mayor, the council, and the manager, the duties of administrative staff, including the city manager and city secretary, and the ability of citizens to petition the government to initiate legislation, repeal adopted legislation, and recall city council members. Changing the home rule will not impact daily life, but does impact citizen control over municipal government. If adopted by the voters, the proposed charter would constitute the governing document of the city of Fort Stockton and would govern the city operations, planning, ordinances, and finances. Making the change would assist the city with long-term planning and allow for greater flexibility in funding sources. The proposed charter would also contain limitations on the powers of the city and its elected and appointed officials. Property and sales tax rates will continue to be determined, as they are now under state law, by the appraisal district or the city, based on valuations and use. Under the new charter, the current process for contesting valuations or utility fees will remain in place. The charter gives citizens the power to recall and referendum. Mayor and city council will transfer from 2-year terms to 3-year terms. The city of Fort Stockton and the Charter Commission will host another town hall meeting Tuesday, October 25th, starting at 5:30. All members of the public are welcome. FSISD hears presentation on potential security upgrades by Sean Yorks. when school safety, with full school safety in the forefront of the news in the wake of Uvalde and Sandy Hook, the FSISD is proposing a security upgrade at all its campuses. Position A of the November 8th school bond election, which has an $84 million cap, includes designated funds for safety and security improvements in the form of secured vestibules, fire alarm systems, radios, bullet-resistant materials, cameras and intercoms, and new door and key card access. The system can handle up to four different radio frequencies. Representatives from Lubbock-based Guardian Security Solutions gave a presentation to FSISD officials and the general public on October 13th at the high school Special Events Center. These are individuals who specialize in some of the latest technology as far as security is concerned, said Superintendent Zamora. They were more than willing to come out here and bring some of their technology for use for us to see. Guardian already secures several law enforcement and government buildings in Pecos County. Guardian Ray Dunn brought samples of the types of security systems his company offers, including cameras and access control systems designed to make school campuses safer. One of the things we found in the years of going through schools is doors being propped open. Guardian provides access control systems that monitor the doors and alerts if a door is open for a specified amount of time. A digital floor plan of each campus will be visible at the school immediately shows doors that are closed and locked or doors that are open. If a door is propped open, an alarm will sound and someone has to respond. Access to each campus will be controlled by key cards given to each employee. When you have an employee request access to the school with one of our badges, it's also going to get a picture from the closest camera. So if someone loses their access control card and someone else finds it to get to the school, you've got proof that it wasn't the person it was assigned to. The system also includes detectors for situations ranging from vaping in the restroom to gunshots. Let's say you've got a vape detector in the bathroom. You pick the closest camera to that bathroom. Obviously, it's got to be on the outside. So if someone goes in there and vapes, now it'll pop up when the alarm is set off. It's going to pop up that the camera, and it will stay there until somebody clears it. Then you have the opportunity to look and see who has the guilty look on their face when they come out of the restroom. Dunn reminded the audience of a shooting in the girls' restroom in Alpine several years ago, saying the system would pick that up as well as calls for help. Dunn said Guardian will custom make a security system to fit the school district's needs. What works best for Fort Stockton? He asked, do you need a panic system? Do you need access control or knowing when the door is propped open? To my knowledge, we are the company that can set up a system that will alert. The November 8th bond includes two propositions. In addition to school security, Proposition A includes new buses and fleet vehicles, campus upgrades such as furniture, HVAC and roof repairs, technology upgrades, career and technical education such as auto and cosmetology retrofit, and a new FFA barn. Proposition B includes stadium and athletic facility accessibility and equity upgrades for Title IX and ADA compliance. Warnick to run for mayor in 2023 by Nathan Heuer. Another name has been thrown into the hat for the Fort Stockton mayoral race next May. City Councilman James Warnock informed the Pioneer on October 12th that he intends to run for mayor or following Chris Alexander's current and final term. Alexander confirmed last May that he will not be running for mayor again. Warnock was reelected for city council for a two-year term this past May's election. If elected for mayor, the Fort Stockton City Council will then appoint a councilperson for a one-year term. Warnock, 58, began his tenure as a city councilman in 2017 and has served various roles on city boards for 17 years. He believes he would be an ideal candidate for the position because of his presence and his relationships with the county and school. The 1982 Fort Stockton graduate is the director of transportation and a volunteer firefighter. I'd like to see all three entities work with each other. I don't know what it was like in the past. I personally think we're small enough where we need to work with each other. I don't have a problem with anybody. The city councilman's vision for Fort Stockton in the future is to enable the local economy to prosper by recruiting a variety of businesses to town. I feel like I could come up with a plan for growth here in Fort Stockton. I'm a proactive person, like to see positive growth. I'm not saying we're not doing it now. I feel like I can bring some things to the table. I just don't see growth here. I see a lot of windmills and solar farms, but I don't see a lot of anything else. It worries me. When asked about another previously hot topic in town, a new recreation center, Warnock explained that he'd like to see one built in the future through collaboration of financial resources between the city, council, and school, when all entities are in a position to do so. We talked about this rec center in the past, and it's going to take the school, the county, and the city to make it work. When talking $22 million like they were looking at, there's a lot of money. We have to come up with a plan, and all three are going to have to agree with it. Warnock is now the second candidate who has announced their intentions to run for mayor, joining former Councilwoman Pam Palaleo, who announced her candidacy in May. County calls for December election to create hospital district by Sean Yorks. Registered voters participating in the November 8th election who reside inside Pecos County and outside the IRN hospital district boundaries will have opportunity to return to the ballot box once again on December 10th to decide whether or not to create a Pecos County Memorial Hospital. The Pecos County Commissioners approved the hospital's petition to create the district at its September 26th meeting. The motion to call for the election passed without discussion. Election day for the hospital district special election will take place Saturday, December 10th. In other business, the commissioners approved a line item transfer for additional funds needed by the Texas A&M Extension Service. Extension agent Karen Helfelfinger said agency ran out of money due to increased fuel costs. We appreciate your support and your continued support in the past. We ended up running out of fuel money this year. She said that increasing costs of fuel and increased demand from Texas A&M to attend additional conferences in College Station was the cause of the additional request for funds. The commission approved the request. The commissioners approved renewal of the Hartford Senior Medical Insurance Plan for the Pecos County Group Retiree Insurance for 2023. Rates increased by 4.8%. Commissioners approved an agreement with West X Design of Fort Stockton for website maintenance. The commission amended its contract for IRN Airport fuel sales with David Hardwick of Fort Stockton Aviation and a new contract with Jeffrey McMahon of No Runways, LLC. The contract took effect October 1st and is good through September 30th, 2026. They awarded a bid for a 4,000-gallon water truck for Precinct 4 to Bruckner's Truck Sales for a 2024 Mack truck at a cost of over $189,000. The other bid received was for a 2013 Peterbilt from Arlington Equipment at a cost of $149,500. Approved two 30-foot easements for a flow line and electric line for Diamondback E&P. TxDOT gives update on widening project by Sean Yorks. With a growing population and an increase in truck traffic, Highway 80-285 between Fort Stockton and Pecos has become a more dangerous road to travel. With that in mind, the Texas Department of Transportation is in the preliminary stages of a project that will widen a 49-mile stretch of the highway from two lanes to a four-lane divided highway. The estimated cost of the project is $400 million, and right-of-way and utility relocation cost is $40 million. According to TxDOT, the road experienced 540 recorded crashes and 10 deaths between 2015 and 2019, and 33% of those were rear-end collisions. Traffic has increased 21% during that time, and the population has increased 6.5% in Pecos County, 11% in Reeves County. Traffic is projected to increase another 30% through 2030. The corridor sees a significant amount of commercial vehicle traffic. Much of this is associated with the energy sector. On average, 29% of the traffic on US 285 South is truck traffic. The stretch between Farm to Market 2007 and Farm to Market 7076 is 40% truck traffic, and 2018 saw the highest number of crashes. Since 2018, crashes have decreased, which is likely due to reduced speeds as a result of construction and passing lane improvements. TxDOT held its first virtual public meeting July 7, 2021, and conducted a traffic study during the fall and winter of 2021. An environmental analysis is ongoing, and a final schematic of the project is expected next summer, with a third public meeting in 1 year and the environmental impact approval expected in spring 2024.
Hello, I'm Jesse. I'm reading from the Monahans News for Thursday, October 13th. Vasquez asked commissioners about ballpark locked gate. The story was written by Jan Cranfield. At the end of Tuesday's Ward County Commissioners Court, Grand Falls resident Robert Vasquez addressed the court concerning the locked gate on the Grand Falls ballpark. Quote, "I don't want to call anybody out. I don't want to throw anyone under the bus, but we have been told point blank that the ballpark is not to be used, and that's just the way it is," Vasquez told the court. Vasquez pointed out that there are kids in Grand Falls who want to play baseball but cannot access the park because of the locked gate. Quote, "The kids don't have anything to do in Grand Falls. We need something for them to do. Being able to play baseball might keep some of them out of trouble," Vasquez added. Ward County Precinct 3 Commissioner Dexter Nichols covers Grand Falls. Quote, "We were getting a lot of damage done at the park, lights torn down and such, so we locked the gate," Nichols told Vasquez. Quote, "I understand the problem, but something needs to be done so the kids can use the park. Parents in Grand Falls are fine with doing the cleanup so the ballpark can be used," Vasquez said. Nichols added, quote, "I guess someone in Grand Falls needs to be responsible for keeping a key to the gate so it can be locked and unlocked," end quote. Quote, "Then I guess that would be me. Everyone knows I have been trying to get someone to do something to fix the problem," Vasquez said. Vasquez's concern was listened to, but no solution was presented or agreed upon by the court. In other business, the commissioners approved the purchase of a new ambulance for the Ward County Emergency Medical Services. EMS Director Michael Enriquez said, quote, "The vehicle chassis will be a 2023 Dodge Ram 5500 cab and chassis. When the chassis is ready to go, the turnaround time for the completion of all needed specification will be around 12 months, end quote. The new ambulance is estimated to cost approximately $341,000. Quote, "We have had the money put aside for this for a while," said Ward County Judge Craig Holly. In other actions, the court also approved accepting a $15,000 donation to the Ward County Sheriff's Office from Two Rivers Pipeline Construction out of appreciation for the quick recovery of tools stolen from the company. Quote, "We will use some of the money to purchase equipment such as vest and body cams," Sheriff Ferman Valle said. In regular business, commissioners approved a bid from Gay and Son Masonry, L.P., in the amount of $48,800 for masonry work at the new Event Center Park. In other action, the court approved to seek an architect firm to create plans for the new law enforcement center. Along with Nichols and Holly, commissioners present for the meeting were Tino Sanchez, Larry Hanna, and Eddie Nelms. The next regularly scheduled meeting will be October 24th at 9:30 a.m. in the Ward County Courthouse Commissioner's Courtroom, located on the first floor at 400 South Allen Street. Mayor proclaims Chamber of Commerce Week, World Polio Day. City refunds $20,000 in utility deposits. The story was written by Christy Sullivan. In recognition of the contribution that the Monahans Chamber of Commerce provides to the city, the Monahans City Council approved a proclamation declaring October 17th through 21st as Chamber of Commerce Week during the Tuesday meeting. On behalf of the city, Mayor Adam Steen presented the proclamation to Chamber Executive Director Teresa Burnett and board members Rex Thee and Jeppy Wilson. Quote, "We are very proud of the work that the Chamber does for the city and the leadership that Teresa provides, Steen said. Mayor Steen also proclaimed October 24th as World Polio Day and encouraged all citizens to join the fight to help eradicate the disease. Also in attendance during the meeting was council members Richard Hawkins, Rudy Hernandez, Ivy Valenzuela, and Calvin Carroll. In other business, a resolution was approved by the council which will refund utility deposits to City of Monahan's Utility Department customers. As per city ordinance, a utility deposit shall be refunded to any customer under the following conditions. The account has been active in the name of the same customer for a period of 3 years. There have been no cutoffs of such account in such 3-year period, and there have not been any late payments or delinquent notices on the customer's record for the same 3-year period. The ordinance came from a recommendation by former city manager David Mills in 2015. The refunds will be credited to the customer's water bill as opposed to mailing a check. Total amount to be refunded as of October 1st is $20,340. In regular business, a resolution was approved which is City Manager Rex Thee's certification on all improvements to the East Monahan Subdivision drainage conveyance on the I-20 access road have been completed up to city code. In final actionable item, an independent audit agreement with Smith and Reeves PC for fiscal year end September 2022 was approved. The cost for the audit is between $39,000 and $59,000, Thee said. The City Council meets every second and fourth Tuesday of the month at 3 p.m. Anyone wanting to address the City Council on the topics addressed in this story or any other topic may do so by asking to be added to the meeting agenda in the City Secretary's office located inside City Hall or by appearing at the meeting during the public comments section of the meeting, which is on every agenda. The next City Council meeting will be held at 3 p.m. on Tuesday, October 25th, in the Council Chambers at City Hall, 112 West 2nd Street. Monahan's man booked for sexual assault of a child. The story was written by Christy Sullivan. Ward County Sheriff's Office investigated a Monahan's man for allegedly sexually assaulting a child. Although details are vague, Ward County Sheriff Ferran Valle said deputies were notified to investigate an alleged sexual assault of a child on August 21st around 7 p.m. During the investigation, deputies discovered the suspect, later identified as Travis Corey Harmon, age 31, of 3809 South Veronica Street, had sexually assaulted a child, Valle said. Based on evidence received, deputies were able to obtain an arrest warrant for Harmon, and he was subsequently arrested on October 10th and charged with sexual assault of a child, a second-degree felony. The offense can be punishable by imprisonment in the Texas Department of Criminal Justice for any term of not more than 20 years or less than 2 years, and a fine not to exceed $10,000. Astorga given 5 years for 2020 burglary. The story was written by Christy Sullivan. A Monahan's man involved in a 2020 burglary of a home on South Bruce Street was sentenced on September 30th to prison. Louis Hector Astorga, age 48, of 916 South Main, appeared in front of 143rd Judicial District Judge Mike Swanson and waived his right to a jury trial, and as part of a plea agreement, Astorga pleaded guilty to the charge of burglary of a habitation, a second-degree felony. Astorga and his accomplice, Stacy Talana Morris, age 32, of Eustis, were both arrested after burglarizing a vacant home in the 1100 block of South Bruce on June 14, 2020. Lieutenant Stormy Laws was conducting a welfare check on a vacant home when he located the pair. Astorga, who had active blue warrants at the time, fled on foot, and spent 3 days on the lam before being located at a house in the 800 block of North Alice Avenue after police received a tip as to his whereabouts. Morris was arrested at the time of the incident and charged. She accepted a plea agreement and admitted to her role in the burglary in December 2020 and was given 7 years deferred adjudication. According to the indictment, Astorga has two prior convictions of burglary of a building in June 1993 in Ward County and January 1999 in Reeves County. He was also convicted of injury to a child, elderly, disabled, with intent bodily injury in Pecos County and a possession of controlled substance in Upshur County. Astorga was ordered by Swanson to serve 5 years confinement in the Institutional Division of the Texas Department of Public Safety. He was further ordered to pay court costs of $498, and he was given credit for 833 days time served.
Thank you for joining us for this week's edition of Far West Texas. This is the Recording Library of West Texas, enriching the lives of individuals with physical, visual, and learning disabilities since 1963. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.